Okay, so tonight I'm going to continue with this process I started last week, deconstructing the Satipatthana Sutta. Last week, remember, we basically looked at this introductory sentence. Here, monks, in regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent or ardent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. So the Buddha was sort of saying, here's how you want to approach these instructions I'm going to give you. And now, we're going to start actually looking at the instructions themselves. And basically, we're going to take apart each of the first three sets of instructions in some detail. This is the first set. Here, gone to the forest or the root of a tree or to an empty hut, he sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, sets his body erect and establishes mindfulness in front of him. Mindful, he breathes in, mindful, he breathes out. Breathing in long, he knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long, he knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he knows I breathe in short. Breathing out short, he knows I breathe out short. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the whole body. He trains thus, I shall breathe in calming the bodily formation. He trains thus, I shall breathe out calming the bodily formation. So there's a enormous amount of instruction here, actually. And I want to sort of take it a little bit at a time. And first of all, you notice that at the very beginning, like, go to the forest there and sit at the root of a tree or in an empty hut. Well, in our world, we're probably not going to do that. but we are going to try. The idea of that was simply find some place that's quiet where you won't be disturbed. I mean, this is a very rural, culture, and people tended to live in villages, and there was lots of forest and wild space in between the villages. And he was basically saying, go out into the wilder spaces where the people aren't going to bother you so much. And also notice the posture where he's emphasizing that you should be erect and alert. Right? Sitting cross-legged, once again, in that culture, was like a perfectly normal thing to do. Not, people didn't have chairs in their houses, right? They sat on the ground to do everything. So sitting cross-legged on the ground or on a mat or whatever would be a perfectly normal thing to do. Once again, in our culture, this is less, it's not essential in any sense of the word. But then those are the instructions he gave. And then he says this really interesting thing. He says, and having established mindfulness in front of him. Having established mindfulness in front of him. And what does in front of him mean? And this is when we start getting some really rather interesting ideas. Because there's lots of different thoughts about this in various commentaries I came across. Initially, it was understood by in front of him, it literally meant in front of your face. So, which meant understanding that you would focus your mind on the air as it goes in and out of your nostrils. This is what the typical translation or interpretation of this meant. And that's fine, but and then Anileo says this rather interesting thing. Therefore, although to understand in front to indicate the nostril area makes sense in relation to mindfulness of breathing, alternative ways of practice based on a more figurative understanding of the term cannot be categorically excluded. In fact, several modern teachers, that's us, have developed successful approaches to mindfulness of breathing independent of the nostril area. Some, for example, advise their pupils to experience the breath in the chest area. Others suggest observing the air element at the abdomen, while still others recommend directing awareness to the act of breathing itself without focusing on any specific location. So there's, in other words, in modern day mindfulness teaching and practice, there's a lot of different ways where these words in front of you might mean. Certainly it's been my experience from the different teachers I've practiced with at various times that I've heard lots of variations of this. The idea of focusing just on the nostrils is there's a whole school of mindfulness practice where this is quite strictly adhered to as a way of making the practice very precise and emphasizing the concentration nature of mindfulness. Because you really have to concentrate because the flow of air in and out of the nostrils over your upper lip is pretty subtle. Whereas, watching the abdomen expand is a lot more action. Right? It's just the different schools of thought have different ideas on this. And then he says, and then the next thing in the sutta, he says, breathing in, long, you breathe in long, breathe out long, you breathe, et cetera, long and short. And this implies two things. One is he's pointing already, the Buddha's pointing to refine your attention. Don't just pay attention to the breath, pay attention to the quality, the nature of your breath. That's one thing he's saying. But the other thing he's saying, and this I found in the commentaries, is that he starts with saying, notice that when you're breathing in long, and then he goes to, and then notice when you're breathing in short. And these are actually could be taken as sequential instructions, because when we initially start paying attention to the breath, when our mind is still sort of not really focused, we tend to breathe much longer breaths. And as the mind becomes more refined and focused and concentrated, the mind no will notice that the breath has become smaller, shorter. So he's actually pointing to this idea that your breath changes as you get more concentrated, and in listing them in that order, he's pointing to the fact that this is something you should notice. And this is, Analeo says, nevertheless, the progression from knowing longer breaths to knowing shorter breaths reflects the fact that the breath naturally becomes shorter and finer with continued contemplation, owing to increasing mental and physical calmness. So there was actually intent, even in putting longer before shorter. Then he says, in the next thing he says in the sutta, is you breathe in, experiencing the whole body. And then he trains, and you breathe out, experiencing the whole body. Once again, there's actually two very distinctly different interpretations of what this means. In one interpretation, basically what it means is pay attention to the entire body with each breath, both inhale and exhale. So that, and this makes you sort of pay attention to a wider selection of sensation, which makes it more precise, and also it gives you a little wider field as opposed to just focusing on, the breath going in and out of your nostrils. You have this much wider field. And certainly when I this is when I have experienced this. This is how this has always been taught to me by my teachers. But there's a whole other way of looking at this, and that's like when we talk about the whole body, what he's talking about is the entire breath, the whole body of a breath. So he's not saying no, pay attention to your abdomen and your shoulders, but pay attention to the process of breathing from the very beginning to the very end, and all the things that happen in just an in-breath. It's a which is has a it's a very different meaning than the whole body, like physical whole body. And I've seen this taught as well. This is, when we when I talk sometimes about practicing aiming and sustaining, trying to see the beginning of the breath and then trying to see the entire progress of the breath. And there is, it seems, some debate, I guess that one you'd say, about which of these interpretations you might want to take. And I think basically, if you look at both of those interpretations as pointing to skillful means, my idea would be, well, which one works best for you? And that would be probably the one you'd choose. But I just want to sort of read what Joseph Goldstein has to say here. And he's talking about this idea that the breath becomes very sort of still and refined. At times, the breath can become very refined, sometimes even imperceptible. We shouldn't try to make the breath stronger in order to be able to feel it. Interesting idea, like, oh, my breath is gone. I better breathe deeply so I have something to pay attention to, right? Rather, let the breath draw the mind down to its own level of subtlety. It's like listening to someone playing a flute as they walk off into the distance. The refinement of the breath can become the vehicle for a further refinement of mind. At those times when it really does disappear and we can't feel it at all, simply be aware of the body sitting until the breath appears again by itself. I understand what he's saying here, because I've certainly experienced in as you get into deeper states of concentration, this is what happens. Your breath quite literally disappears. It's like, what? And that's just normal. And the thing about it is, it seems kind of scary. I'm not breathing anymore. Oh my God. It's you have to watch that you don't get upset by this. This is just what happens. This is just the natural progression of the practice in some cases at some times when you become more concentrated. And it's okay. It's just that's what happens. And then in the sutta, it says, basically, the last bit of the instruction is to pay attention to the calming the bodily formations, and then both on the in-breath and the out-breath. What's he talking about here? What emphasizes basically what he's emphasizing here when he says calming the bodily formations. What this means is try and be as still as you can. This is pointing at the very beginning of the instructions, the importance of stillness when you're doing formal sitting practice. The stiller the body becomes, the stiller the mind becomes, and vice versa. As the mind gets still, the body naturally becomes stiller. So it's a two-way street, and they influence each other. But if you can consciously choose to be still, I'm going to calm my bodily formation when I'm sitting, and then be aware at some level of, that desire to move arising and going, yeah, I don't need to do that. That's what he's pointing to here quite precisely. One more little bit from Joseph here. It's surprising that in our lives we often overlook the breath, and that in our meditation practice we sometimes are bored by it. Not only is each breath sustaining our lives, but being aware and mindful of the breath was also the basis for the Buddha's own awakening. It can be for our own awakening as well. Pay attention, just so essentially. Here's one other sort of layer of thought I have around this. This was like what the Buddha was teaching at a time when almost everything else in the culture was based on Brahmanic tradition, on the, basically the Brahmins said, if you want something to happen, you come and we'll do the right rituals with the right idols in the right temple at the right time when the moon's in the right phase. Da, 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 da. And the Buddha basically was saying, nah, none of that's true. Don't need any of that. You don't need a temple. You don't need an idol in the temple. You don't need anything. All you need is to be able to pay attention to your breath, which at the time was like this really radical thing to say, essentially. This is like, so it's so counter to his culture. And we can't sort of overlook that this was like, he was teaching something that was like so not proper from the point of view of the Brahmins. I mean, basically, he was putting the Brahmins out of business, which upset the Brahmins, by the way, because he was basically saying, you don't need a priest to intervene for you to, experience, the truth. You don't need a priest at all. You don't need someone to do something special. You just need to pay attention to your own breath. It was a radical thing to say at the time. Let's put it that way. Then the Buddha goes on and he talks about paying attention to body position. So this is the next set of instructions. When walking, he knows I am walking. When standing, she knows I am standing. When sitting, he knows I am sitting. When lying down, she knows I am lying down. And he knows accordingly, however his body is disposed. So, from this subtle talking about the breath, he shifts and says, as this is usually interpreted, it's basically what the Buddha is saying here. People say is, well, he's saying practice all the time, because when are you not standing, walking, seated, lying down, or in some other position, right? That's always happening. So the Buddha's trying to sort of once again get people to expand their idea of practice beyond simply sitting, formal sitting practice, saying, no, you can practice all the time. That he's pointing to the idea that this isn't just a sitting practice at all. And then there's a couple of other interesting aspects of this. And the first of these is that when we start paying attention at the level that's being described here, whatever position your body's in other words, all the time, what he's pointing to is the importance of continuity of practice. And this is what Joseph has to say. Mindfulness of body postures Just noticing as we move from one posture to the next throughout the day helps strengthen the continuity of our awareness. This is not complicated. We don't need to be in some heightened state of concentration, and we can practice this as easily outside of retreat as well as in seclusion. Sit and know you're sitting. Walk and know you're walking. Stand and know you're standing. We don't have to be in meditation graduate school to be awake. In the Buddhist time, there were many 7-year-old arhats, fully enlightened beings. I think it was because they could follow the very simplest instructions. Take that with a grain of salt if you want, I certainly do. But it's what he's pointing to is that, look how simple this is. Just pay attention, you know. But and you can pay attention to anything that your body's doing at any time. So for instance, there you are, and you've been sitting, and then you get up to go do what you're going to do next. Like we all have this list of things we got to do, right? And you could say, oh, but I no need for me to rush. So as I'm standing up from sitting, I could notice the sensations of standing up. Be mindful of that. And then I maybe have to, you know, go through from this room into the next room. So you mindful of the stepping towards the door, mindful of your hand reaching out and grabbing the doorknob and turning the doorknob and pulling. And this is all legitimate mindfulness. This is all everything you need to do. It's all there. All you have to do is pay attention to whatever is happening. And of course, you can't spend your whole day doing that because you wouldn't get anything done. Right? We have to sort of be realistic, unless you're on retreat. And then when you're on retreat, this is exactly what I suggest people do, that you just constantly are tuning into what's happening in the moment in this sort of precise way. There's another thing I found interesting that was pointed out. And this is that the actual progression in this instruction. I know I'm walking, I know I'm standing, I know I'm sitting, I'm lying down. Notice the progression from something much more active to something slower and stiller, calmer, less energizing. And the interesting thing is that exactly same sequence occurs in a sutta, a different sutta. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, and this is called the removal of distracting thoughts. And one of the suggestions that Buddha makes for removing distracting thoughts when we're caught in that whirl of distracting thoughts. And this is verse 6. This is step 4 of all of the things you could try. But if while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, he should give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. Slow things down, right? When abandoning of them, his mind becomes steadied, internally quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. And then all of the Buddha is always using these examples of real situations, right? Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? Then he would, what if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. And then he might consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. And then he would consider, why am I sitting? Why not lie down? And he would lie down. By doing so, he would substitute for each grosser posture one that is more subtle. And so what the commentaries are saying here is that the actual order of these instructions in this simple, seemingly simple section of the sutta was quite intentional, because he was saying basically, go to keep, you start with the most, what they call the word is gross, which means lots of action, to the subtlest and simplest. And it's just something to think about. And because that of, I remembered that sutta about working with distracting thoughts, I was like, oh yeah, this is exactly what's going on here. The Buddha is actually consciously saying, here's the progression you might go through when you're paying attention. So it's partly the understanding is this part of this sutta saying, just pay attention all the time. But the other part might be saying more, and pay attention to how you can become more subtle. Can you be more subtle in your action in the world and how you pay attention to it? It's a shift. It's an additional meaning that I'd never come across before until I was studying to prepare for this talk. So. Finally, there's one more section here. And this is where the next section of the sutta, what it has to say. And here he's talking more, and this is often called the section on bodily functions or something like that. When going forward and returning, he acts clearly knowing. When looking ahead and looking away, she acts clearly knowing. When flexing and extending his limbs, he acts clearly knowing. When wearing her robes and carrying her outer robe and bowl, she acts clearly knowing. When eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting, he acts clearly knowing. When defecating and urinating, he acts clearly knowing. When walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent, she acts clearly knowing. And so here we are again, where the Buddha is basically saying, you can't leave anything out. You can't, and it's not like, oh, I can only pay attention to pure and wonderful things. I have to pay, be able to pay attention to whatever I'm actually doing right now. So it's pointing to, once again, how this is like mindfulness in daily life. And it doesn't matter. I mean, you could be paying attention to, like it said, walking around or all those things. But also, defecating and urinating, those are perfectly good things to be mindful of. Whereas normally it would be like, ooh, we don't want to think about those things. But that's just because they're so automatic. But can I actually pay attention to that? Can I be mindful of that? Can I understand that it's a good idea to be mindful of those things? Has a different flavor to mindfulness when you start thinking in those terms of this broader everything is appropriate when it comes to mindfulness. There's nothing, I can't leave anything out at the physical level right now, and then when we get further on, talk about things, other things we don't want to leave out, but. And then there's this other thing that's here, and this was really emphasized when I was reading the sutta. They came up with this idea where he said, "Well, you do this clearly knowing." And there's a long discussion in the commentaries about what does clearly knowing mean. What is Why is that there? So was it just, it's like, why you have to be clearly knowing, which is repeated through the entire sutta over and over and over again. There seems to be at least two or three different ideas around clearly knowing and what it means. One is that clearly knowing means simply that you understand the motivation behind any action that you take. You're about to do something and you go, can you be mindful enough to go, oh, why am I doing this? What's the motivation behind it? Can I see the motivation before I act? Because often we act totally automatically. And to be truly mindful is before we any act of body or speech, we have to go, what's my intention here? This is wise intention. The second step on the Eightfold Path. Can I be mindful enough to look and see what my motivation is over and over and over again, so that everything I do, I'm clearly knowing. And then, sort of related to that, is once I can see the motivation, then you ask the question, is this wholesome? Is this suitable? Is the word that I saw in some of the commentaries. Is this a good idea? Should I actually be speaking this way or doing this? So it's like every act now becomes, I look at it to see why I'm doing it, and then I look, I contemplate in a sense, is this appropriate? Does this lead to wholesomeness? Does this lead to deeper understanding, more clearly knowing? And if it doesn't, why am I doing it? That's one interpretation of clearly knowing. There is another. This is and this is we're, now we're starting to already at this point get into some more of the subtle teachings of the Buddha. You see, this is from Joseph Goldstein's book again. The last aspect of clear comprehension is non-delusion. That is, seeing clearly the three universal characteristics mentioned earlier. We clearly know, oops, I'm crackling the wire here. We clearly know the impermanent, unreliable, and selfless nature of all phenomena. Non-delusion understands that with all of the bodily actions mentioned, there is no one there, no one there doing anything. There's doing without a doer. It's all just empty phenomena rolling on according to the great law of cause and effect. The famous 13th century Japanese Zen master Dzogchen expressed it this way: what is the way of the Buddha? It is the study of self. What is the study of self? It is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. So even here, when he's pointing to the fact that we should be clearly knowing, part of what we're clearly knowing is that we're seeing the impermanent, transitory nature of everything we're doing. Can we notice that? And once again, this is not going to be all the time, but sometimes can we pause and comprehend and see clearly that that's actually what's going on. So he's pointing to this, I mean, quite early in the sutta, really. Already we're into non-delusion and the three things we have to understand. And he's pointing to it through this phrase, clearly knowing. So it isn't just that we know, we clearly know. It's a different layer of understanding, of deeper understanding, of clearer understanding that has to do with seeing the motivation of the action, seeing whether or not this is suitable, whether it's wholesome, and then also seeing underneath everything there's just this stuff going on. It's not me doing something. It's just something being done. it shifts our look at our awareness of things. I have a little line here that says, summary. Seems simple, but dot dot dot. I mean, that's all I can really say. I mean, when you start looking this deep into the sutta and looking at all these sort of subtle little things that are there, it's like, oh, it's a lot more there than I originally understood or thought. And like I said, I've encountered a lot of these things at various times. This business about clearly knowing, I'd never really even paid attention to until I started studying and reading the commentaries about what people said about this. And I was like, oh, I never thought of it quite that way before. And that's really the intention of what I'm trying to do with what I'm doing here. I'm trying to sort of look a little deeper and see what it is that the Buddha was getting at in the more subtle layers of what he was saying and why it was worded in this quite precise way. So, I have to, at this point, finish with a little bit of poetry, of course. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And this poem seemed appropriate somehow. I mean, it's called, It Doesn't Always Smell Like Roses. This body is not flowing with liquid energy. No, and this mind is not awash with peace. I fight myself in every posture. Muscles shriek, fear freezes bone, and a sure sense of failure grows. This too is practice, this ground where grief gains the upper hand and anger casts dark shadows. This is the flip side of delight, is as much the point as any pleasure. This is breathing into life. It's like, oh, I have to pay attention to all of this. I can't leave things out. It's just, I like the subtlety of what she says in some sense. So I'm turning the recording off.